As we age, few things scare me, us, more than not being able to remember. With that, let me start by briefly talking about the Utah Alzheimer's Disease and Related Dementia State Plan. I believe you all have a copy of that. If not, do we have additional copies?
We have more copies, yes.
Okay, so if you want to raise your hand, maybe we can get you some copies if you don't have one. And then I will introduce our distinguished panel of experts. The plan was a collaborative effort in which many individuals in both public and private organizations contributed precious time, financial resources, and valued expertise. Our panel of experts include Nick Zullo. Nick has worked in the Alzheimer's Association Utah chapter since 2006, and as director of the programs and advocacy, he is a geriatric counselor and specializes in counseling persons with early stage dementia. He has developed programming for Utah that has garnered over $1 million in grants funding to the state to improve services to families coping with all aspects of the disease course. Nick's work in developing a project for the U.S. Administration on Aging and Utah Division of Aging and Adult Services resulted in a Cognasium, which is a gymnasium for the brain that emphasizes nutrition, exercise, cognitive activity, social engagement based on numerous studies. Next, we have Matthew Bumgart. Matthew is a senior director for public policy for the Alzheimer's Association in Washington, D.C. His portfolio includes overseeing state government affairs, the public health project with the Center for Disease Control, and the Policy Development Department. Prior to joining the association, Matthew worked for nearly 18 years in the United States Senate. Most recently, he was a legislative director for Senator Barbara Boxer of California, where he supervised the legislative staff, managed all the senator's legislative activities, was a chief legislative strategist. Prior to working for Senator Boxer, Bumgard worked for 10 years for then-Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware, primarily as his legislative assistant for senior policy issues, including health care. Matthew is a native of Seattle and has a degree in communications with a second major in political science from Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. Next, we have Dr. Norman Foster. Dr. Foster is a board-certified geriatric neurologist who has specialized in brain imaging and dementing and neurodegenerative disease for over 30 years. In 2005, his passion for improving Alzheimer's care brought him to the University of Utah Department of Neurology, where he helped establish the Intermountain West's first academic clinic devoted to Alzheimer's disease and related disorders, the Center for Alzheimer's Care, Imaging, and Research. Dr. Foster is a professor in the Department of Neurology, Chief Division of Cognitive Neurology, Director of Center Alzheimer's Care, Imaging, and Research, and Senior Investigator for the Brain Institute at the University of Utah. Dr. Foster's research has focused primarily on brain imaging, clinical drug trials, and the clinical features of pathophysiology and neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's disease, frontal lobe dementia. His work has been widely published in the world's leading medical and scientific journals, and he has lectured internationally on his areas of expertise. Next, we have Senator Karen Morgan. Senator Karen Morgan was first elected to the Utah legislature in 1998 and served in the House of Representatives for 10 years. She was then elected to the Utah Senate in 2008. She is a homemaker and former high school teacher. She was born and raised in Utah and has lived in the Cottonwood Heights Granite area for 28 years. She graduated with honors from the University of Utah with degrees in secondary education and family consumer studies. She currently serves on a variety of community and legislative boards and commissions that include the Executive Appropriations, Legislative Management, Public Education, Appropriations, Economic Development, and Workforce Services, Natural Resources, Utah Scenic Byways, Waterways Task Force, and National Conference on State Legislators Education Committee. So with that, what I would like to do is I would like to start off by asking the panel a few questions, and then we will open it up to the audience. Okay. And let me start with Matthew. Your vision statement, Matthew, is a world without Alzheimer's. What stands in the way of realizing that vision, and how realistic is it?
So what stands in the way, I think, in a word, is commitment. Scientists tell us that that they have the ideas and the technology and the will to find treatments and a cure for this disease, but what they lack is a commitment from the federal government, the commitment that would be needed to invest in research for a treatment and for a cure. This is not something that actually would require expanding government. It would not require fixing the deficit or increasing the deficit or the debt. It's a matter of Washington getting its priorities right in terms of the budget and making that commitment. And I think the lack of that and the lack of understanding that a commitment today can actually save money down the road on Medicare and Medicaid is what the hindrance is at this point.
Okay, thank you. Next question is Dr. Foster. Coming to the University of Utah 7 years ago, you built a diagnostic treatment and research center from scratch here in Utah. What are the greatest needs in our state today and in the next few years for patients and families?
Well, Utah is in a unique position in the United States because it's going to be experiencing the greatest percent increase in the number of people with Alzheimer's disease, and our region will be experiencing the greatest increase of any region in the U.S., yet we're poorly prepared. And so what we need to do is to be able to retool, following some of the recommendations in the state plan, both our workforce as well as attitudes in the state, and provide the kinds of services that patients with these diseases need. It's not just the patients. So all of us are here representing a wide group of interests and disciplines because this is a disease that really requires expertise in many areas. It affects not just patients. It's not just a medical problem, but also involves families and has an impact on neighbors and children, as well as spouses and other family members. It has a huge financial impact. What we need here in Utah is more expert services from a medical point of view, particularly, I believe.
Okay. Thank you. Matthew, I'm going to go back to you with this following question. From your experience in the world of public policy development and advocacy, hearing these needs stated by Dr. Foster, what is it going to take to move the Utah legislature or any state legislative body to act physically on these issues to make Alzheimer's disease and related dementia a physical priority at the state level?
And I'm going to take notes on that.
So I'll start by being absolutely, totally crass. No elected official needs to care one whit about someone with Alzheimer's disease.
Until?
They don't. I want them to. Part of my job is to make sure they care about people like your brother and your family. I want them to. But they don't have to. If their mission is to be good fiscal stewards, they have no choice but to do something about Alzheimer's disease. At the end, we reach the same goal. But that's why I say, to be totally crass, they don't need to. They need to be good fiscal stewards. And where we are headed with Medicare and Medicaid in this country demands that action be taken on Alzheimer's disease, particularly on research. Alzheimer's is one of the big cost drivers in the expenditures on Medicare at the federal level and Medicaid at the state level. And to get to the point of some of the things that Dr. Foster talked about in terms of services for families beyond the research question, to be good fiscal stewards, there needs to be a shifting in the thinking. One of the biggest on the Medicare side, on the acute care side, one of the big expenditures, probably the most expensive part of healthcare, is being in the hospital. On the Medicaid side, one of the biggest expenditures is long-term care in nursing facilities. And in both cases, there are things that can be done. There are ways that the healthcare system can be restructured and there are policies and programs that can be put in place at the state government level that not only do what's best for people with Alzheimer's, but have the effect of delaying nursing home care, delaying placement in a nursing home, or keeping people out of the hospital in the home or community-based setting or in an outpatient-based setting. So I want every elected official to care about people with Alzheimer's, but to reach what needs to be done, they don't need to. They need to care about fiscal responsibility.
Okay, thank you. Nick, this question is for you. In state funding, is state funding the first priority here in Utah? Are these things that can be done or can essentially progress be made, at least initially, without a legislative price tag? What are the priorities currently?
Thank you for those questions. That complicated question, I think I'd like to start by saying, in terms of commitment and what legislators need to do and what kind of people they need to be, we're privileged to be in the presence of a great legislator today. I so much appreciate Senator Karen Morgan. She's done tremendous things that have impacted our state. She sponsored the legislation, championed that legislation that provides a state plan. And so I might mention, those who might be listening to this on an archive broadcast, this is a full room. Compliments to the University of Utah, to the students, for their interest in being here today. If some of you are here because politics, is your future, we have a mentor and a model here in Senator Karen Morgan, and we would love for you to become the kind of committed legislator on a state level or a federal level, because this is the beginning, really, of the game. And in the years ahead is when we are going to see the progress that may help us realize a world without Alzheimer's. So I want to answer the question, does that require funding? Do we need to find a way to get the legislature to put dollars on the table to fund, etc.? We have a long ways to go and a lot of interaction to achieve to have that kind of commitment come forward, but we do have a 5-year action plan that has faith and commitment that will come about, but there are many steps that don't initially require that there be fiscal notes attached. This is an action plan that has 5 important goals, the first one of which is a dementia-aware Utah. What is the fiscal note attached to that? There are recommendations and strategies, but I think that all of us can bring that goal about through educating ourselves and through interaction and through advocacy. So not necessarily. It's a public-private partnership. We're actually implementing that plan today. This is all about goal number one, and several recommendations are being hit, several strategies today through this interaction here at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. But an example of not requiring legislation with a fiscal note is, for example, the collaboration, the changing view of agencies now in terms of, even in the past several months as a result of the discussion, some legislative activity, agencies beginning to think in terms of how do we coordinate. For a number of years, there have been the area agencies on aging increasing their level of coordination and concern about this disease. Right now, funding, in a sense, is available in that there is now a sort of shifting of available funds for short-term intensive training for companies in our state. Those funds have been available and have come available through legislation, short-term intensive training. Now those funds are shifting to providing training for home watch caregivers so that their CNAs have now, through supportive funding, of training that cost that great company money. There's a shared public-private partnership to provide dementia care training so that there is greater competency now happening. Dozens of companies now have taken advantage of or beginning to take advantage of that funding. So we have to be creative. We have to think in terms of public-private partnerships to bring about the strategies that are envisioned in this five-year action plan.
Thank you. Can you follow up? Yes.
Can I jump on that? Because I want to. I actually think it's important to back up a step and understand that what's happening in Utah is important. I think it's an absolutely great state plan, and I told Nick that in private, so it's not just a public flattery thing. But it is. Utah is now one of 38 states in the District of Columbia across the country that have either published an Alzheimer's state plan or are in the process of writing a state plan. And the federal government, always being a little bit behind the states, finally got into the act this last May and published a national strategy to address the Alzheimer's crisis. And what made me realize that we ought to step back is that there are a lot of common elements. When Nick was talking about public-private partnerships and collaborations, I think if you looked across all of the published state plans as well as the national plans, you'll see that's a common theme in how to go about addressing in the environment in which we're operating today, the political and economic environment, the way to go about addressing public policy is the recognition that there needs to be more collaboration among, in Utah's case, state agencies. In the federal government's case, federal agencies. You had Medicare and the Administration on Aging and the National Institutes of Health and the Veterans Administration and the FDA all doing stuff on Alzheimer's disease and never talking to each other and never coordinating their activities. And I think that's starting to change now with the national plan. There's also a recognition in the national plan that there needs to be public-private partnerships, whether it's in public awareness campaigns to reduce stigma or to increase early detection and diagnosis, or whether it's in public-private ventures on research. And then there's there's collaboration between the federal government and the state. The national plan actually takes what some probably consider a novel approach for the federal government, and that's not putting mandates on states, but actually saying we need to do things collaboratively. And what we at the federal government need to do is develop some models, for example, for care transitions when people with Alzheimer's move from one healthcare setting to another or one from the hospital home. And we need to develop some models so that when states are actually implementing it, within their Medicaid programs, that they have some examples to turn to, and we can collaborate in that sort of way. So I think the movement is big in Utah. It's important what's happening here. I just thought it was important to put it in a little bit broader context that this is something that's going on around the country and nationally. And when you consider that today there are over 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease. And it's estimated that it will cost America $200 billion this year just to care for those with Alzheimer's, and that 70% of that $200 billion, $140 billion, is Medicare and Medicaid, so it's taxpayer dollars. You can understand why there is a growing recognition that we all need to work together to find innovative, creative public policy solutions.
You know, a related question, what is the cost for changing perceptions? What is the cost to eliminating misconceptions? Again, the goal of a dementia-aware Utah requires education. One of the top priorities that has been discussed by the task force and the ongoing public policy group is what can we do within the realm of public education? And so there are some things being looked at there, whereas there are enlightened schools and teachers who come to the Alzheimer's Association and develop curriculum on Alzheimer's disease and related dementia within health curriculum? What about the court system? What about the UTA driver on whose bus a younger onset individual in his or her 30s, 40s, or 50s needs public transportation and some consideration and awareness, a dementia-aware Utah, because he or she no longer is able to drive because of the disease course. So it just goes across society. And I think it begins with the question, such as in this room or in any room or any classroom or in any medical school or in any legislature. And the question is, do you understand that there is a fundamental difference between normal age-related memory loss and Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia? And we think that is just too basic. No, it is not too basic. It really requires some perception improvement and some elimination of misconceptions. An example is a live example, a real example is a prominent individual in our community sitting around a table arguing with his mom and with his sisters about the recent diagnosis of his 82-year-old father with Alzheimer's disease, pounding the table and saying, "Dad is 82 years old, for crying out loud. This isn't Alzheimer's disease," quote unquote, not understanding that this is a disease course. It is not normal aging. If it was, everyone 65 and older would have Alzheimer's disease. And so that is really the basics. Even in the primary care physician practices, declining to diagnose the disease because the physician is thinking there's nothing that can be done anyway. So what is the cost of getting to that point and that step-by-step? And all of us need to be enlisted in that process. We call it the stigma of this disease. And so what comes first? Do we eliminate that and therefore we get funding? We have to move on this front, and all of us really have to be those committed individuals.
Thank you. Those are some good responses. And I'm the moderator. I don't want to get this out of hand, so don't make me go Candy Crowley on you, all right? Okay, the next question is for Senator Morgan. As a politician, and I use that term in the most noble and practical context, how can this state plan, with its many goals and detailed strategies, ever be realized in such a conservative climate as we have in the Utah legislature? Is the concept of public-private partnership mentioned a few times in the plan an enabling concept or just pure fantasy?
Well, it is a challenge. I want to give you a little bit of a background here, and that is four pieces of legislation were run through the legislature. I carried four pieces, and the first one was just a resolution that had a lot of information in it, just the facts. It was to help with the public awareness. It was also to help educate legislators, help them to understand the facts surrounding Alzheimer's and related dementias. And that, I carried that, I believe, in 2010. And then in 2011, we came back and carried legislation that would create an Alzheimer State Plan Task Force. And we were able to get that through because of the piece of, the year before, the public awareness or the education of legislators, and also some public awareness through a resolution as well when you carry that. Then we went all over the state. We held meetings and with caregivers and providers and anyway, held those meetings and got input from those people and the experts on what is needed in a 5-year state plan. And so I believe we put together the ideal plan. I mean, it's incredible. We had so many wonderful people come to the table and share their experiences and their expertise with us, and we put together this plan that you have today. So, this last session, I carried a piece of legislation that put the state plan into statute. So, it's there. I also carried another piece of legislation to implement some of the provisions in the plan that didn't cost a dime, wouldn't cost the state anything. Now, I had some pushback with both pieces of legislation. I carried it through the Senate, and it went pretty well. The state plan, the language that put the state plan into statute. We had, you know, some opposition, people who felt like if they were to even vote in support of that, then that means that they were endorsing an entirely new program. And they didn't want to do that. And so that's why we had those no votes. And it went over into the House and had some trouble over there. We were able to get enough votes in both the House and the Senate to pass it. And so it is a state plan. And I am so grateful for that and for all of my colleagues who were willing to listen and who were willing to vote in favor, because that was not an easy vote for them to take. It's quite a commitment. However, on the fourth bill, the second bill this session, that took some pieces out of the plan so that we could actually implement those and gave some direction to agencies, I could not get that bill out of the Senate committee, the Health and Human Services Committee. And the pushback was, this is something that should be done in the private sector. This is not something that we should be doing at the legislative level. This is something that will grow government. And so, you know, you just heard the arguments of basically the political parties. You know, less government is better. Some believe that. Others believe that there's a place for a government program because sometimes a government program can, well, first of all, provide services to the citizens of the state, but also can save taxpayers' money. And I believe that this plan is a win-win and that legislation to implement those provisions was a great bill and would actually do that. But right now, the climate in the legislature is not such that we can get through these provisions. Now, these are the ones that didn't have any funding attached to them. And so there are other provisions, of course, that have a price tag. And I don't see that we'd be able to get those things right away. But we can be very creative. As Mr. Zullo has said, you know, the agencies are now working together, and there is still an Alzheimer's public policy group that's meeting and working. And I think there's a lot of hope for this plan. I am so pleased that we have the plan and that the citizens can refer back to that and the agencies can refer to that. And Dr. Foster can use that because we've laid the groundwork. And now we can go forward. But to go forward, maybe through the legislative process, is going to be difficult, very difficult, with the climate we're in right now. But that doesn't mean that we can't do something and that we can't work on the issue, because certainly we have to. You know, it's such an important issue.
Let me just add that Alzheimer's disease really should be and largely is a nonpartisan issue. Even despite difficult financial conditions throughout the country and in specific states, the Republican Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin has decided to sustain funding from his state to the state university for Alzheimer's care and research programs, uncut. Likewise, we know that California is in severe financial problems, and there, Governor Jerry Brown has also decided to sustain funding for an extensive system at state universities for Alzheimer's care outreach and also, to a lesser extent, research. So this is not something that is Republican or Democrat. And in fact, what Utah has a specific role to play. We have a specific problem in Utah. We need Utah solutions to that problem. And we have strengths that are unique. We value families, and this is a issue of families. And we can unite as Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals, to try to help support families. Furthermore, I think that we must recognize that the state traditionally has played an important role in caring for the elderly and those in need. And what we're talking about is change in how the state is funding these kinds of efforts. Right now, they have in the system decided to pay for only the most expensive and restrictive solutions and forcing families to move their loved ones out of home into institutions to receive care rather than being able to support quality of life in homes where patients and their families want to be. So it's those kinds of change based upon increased knowledge and understanding of what high-quality dementia care is that needs to be implemented here in the state. Not new programs, different ways to address these increasing problems. It's too expensive the way we're doing it now.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I actually, Senator Morgan, I thought, made a very interesting point about agencies working together and not having to go do stuff that does not require necessarily going back through the legislature.
Sure.
And if you look at the national plan that was released in May, there's 63 specific action steps, and not a single one of them requires Congress to do anything. All 63 are aimed at actions that agencies can take within the next 12 to 24 months. And the federal government is going to come back every year and update the plan between now and 2025. So I can't say necessarily that that will always be the case, but I think it's very interesting that given circumstances and the climate, that the national plan actually speaks only to agencies, so they don't have to go through Congress.
Okay. Thank you. What I would like to do is turn the mic over to the audience, and I'm going to ask you to state your name and speak clearly. But because I have the first mic, I get to ask the first question. Just very briefly, though, because we are an audience of really young people, I thought I something that happened that just I just can't get out of my mind when I was in Washington. Nick, I had this lady get up and say that her husband, of 39 years of age, had been diagnosed with the early onset of Alzheimer's. And we view as Alzheimer's as an old people's disease. Is it because it's being diagnosed earlier? How are we, or is it that people are now able to diagnose it? Or how is it now that we are finding this, that it's no longer just an old person's age, or disease, rather?
Okay, I'll talk about that. Maybe Dr. Foster want to talk about that. I think of Dr. Alzheimer and the first case of Alzheimer's disease at the turn of the century was 46 years old and died at age 55. And there never has been any such thing as senile dementia. So we think in terms of senility, that's old age. That's not the case. We work with families who are we call younger onset. And so I think that that recognition is very tough. There are some great primary care physicians who have found and diagnosed this disease in younger age. And walking that journey with those families, we have seen that that has not been an easy thing to accomplish, an easy diagnosis. But we're seeing that more and more, and we're very pleased about that. But I think the increasing diagnostics, increasing awareness, this is a completely different world in terms of the ability to have a family be blessed with an accurate and dignified diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or of a specific related neurodegenerative dementia, frontotemporal dementia, dementia with Lewy bodies, because that then means a differential plan of treatment. And this is a different world from, say, just 5 years ago in terms of that opportunity for families to get that kind of care. And there's a lot that can be done. Families do not say, I don't want to know. They do want to know. They do want a diagnosis. And there is so much in terms of personal and family planning. It changes the lifestyle of an individual, one of whom is often quoted by myself, an early stage person with Alzheimer's disease. There is a whole lot of life after diagnosis, quote unquote. And she's very busy spending her children's inheritance right now, busier than she might otherwise have been at age 68, 69. And so I think that's part of the reason why we have this increasing capacity for an accurate diagnosis.
Anything?
Well, we have new diagnostic tools. We can be more accurate, more specific. And I think also we are asking the question. One of the problems with our understanding Alzheimer's disease is for decades, physicians never ask, what is this and why? And so the individual that you were talking about a decade or two ago probably would have been admitted to a state mental hospital, and the assumption was that this was some disease, maybe it was a mental disorder, and never was able to get appropriate evaluation or management. And in fact, this historical record is something that weighs down our field, because people have not ask these questions, and often we are too accepting of mismanagement and mistreatment. Too often people are not getting the kind of care they need. In no such serious illness is there such a gap between what we can do today and what most patients with this disease experience. And that's where it's this gap that we can really make a difference with.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to open it up to the audience. And again, please state your name, and if you are directing the question to any specific person on the panel, please let us know.
Hi, my name is Adam Wallace. This question is probably...
Could you stand up, please?
This question is probably for you, Dr. Foster. In the report, it says that Utah has the highest rate of Alzheimer's disease. Do we have any idea why Utah has the highest rate, or if there are any specific risk factors
that we can reduce? Yes, we know quite a bit about Alzheimer's disease in Utah because of the Cache County study run through the Utah State University. So we're actually in a very knowledgeable position. But the reason that Utah and the Intermountain West is most affected is because, good news, we're living longer. And we have some of the longest life expectancy. In addition, on average, we're a young state. And so unlike Florida, where the population already has a high proportion of elderly, in Utah, this proportion is increasing very rapidly. Another factor is that older Utahns tend to stay in Utah. Maybe they go to St. George, or maybe they move around, but they, unlike in North Dakota, for example, where people tend to move to the southern United States, people in Utah tend to stay here. And then the final factor is our state's population is growing. There are a lot of people who are moving to our state, including the parents of younger people who've decided to move or live here. And so all of these factors together bring on the tsunami of Alzheimer's disease, which corresponds to the baby boom tsunami as well. As you know, last year was the first year of this baby boom tsunami when the baby boomers are beginning to retire, and that's what we're going to be experiencing over the next decade increasingly.
Thank you. Anybody else want to? Okay. If not, next question.
Hi, my name's Chase Hunsaker. The question's for you, Matthew, but it goes off of something Dr. Foster kind of said. First of all, you said that the plan for Utah was a great plan, but then Dr. Foster, you said something along the lines that we need to change it a little bit, that we're going too much with sending the Alzheimer's people to other facilities like rest home type places and not bringing it home, and that would save us money. What do you think, Matthew, would improve our plan? Because if it's a great plan, it's not perfect. What do you think we could do to improve Utah's plan?
I actually think, just to clarify, that Dr. Foster was actually speaking about the current existing system,
not the plan.
Tending to favor the more expensive types of care over things that would be least expensive and, ironically, the things that people prefer, and not so much what the plan does. I've looked at all 25 published state plans of the 25 that have been published, and Utah's is really good. And I think the focus needs to really be on implementation right now, rather than say, on top of this or in addition to this, we need to do X, Y, and Z. One of the things that when the Alzheimer's Association started the campaign to get states to adopt state plans back in 2007, 2008, the purpose was because each state is unique, each state understands its own needs and capacity, and for them to craft what solutions they needed for themselves. And so I would really, I don't think at this point in time there isn't anything that should be done except working on implementing the work that has been done.
I just want to confirm that what Matt says, I was talking about the current situation and how the plan actually says that these changes are needed.
Yes.
The other thing that I failed to mention about the uniqueness of Utah is that we're a largely medically underserved area, and in addition have a large rural population, as well as Native American population and a growing minority population who are very much underserved too. And I think that we have some unique challenges, particularly with the distribution of our population and these underserved areas, to take advantage of telehealth services to provide these services more widely. We heard testimony in the task force of individuals in southern Utah who were stuck with either deciding to send a loved one 400 or 500 miles to find an expert, or have to do without and then get substandard care, or maybe the kind of care that the family didn't really want. So these are things that we can work on, and perhaps some details can be added. But I think the question right now, not only is the implementation, but also, this is where maybe some of you as students can help, the translation of what is said in the plan to something that's actionable and by the legislature and can be discussed in the political realm, because this is not a political document, really. It's a document to help guide the state for the public and also for the legislature.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi, my name is Teresa Derringer. First, thank you, panel. My question is for Dr. Foster. Doctor, could you take just a minute or two to tell us what the most positive, newest findings are in treatment?
Well, treatment of Alzheimer's disease is a challenge. As we go on, we understand more and more how complex it is. There are a couple of things that have come out in the past couple of months that are exceedingly exciting. One of them is that we now have studies from young onset familial cases in which we have very good evidence of how the disease evolves, and that it evolves over quite a long period of time. New diagnostic criteria recognize that there are changes in the brain. There's evidence that the brain starts to get off track years, maybe even decades, before symptoms develop. So that gives us an opportunity to intervene and prevent Alzheimer's disease. And there are many ways in which that's being pursued. The second thing I would mention is a very exciting finding from a large genetic study in Iceland, indicating that there can be inherited genes that prevent the development of Alzheimer's disease in families. So unfortunately, it's a rare mutation that was identified in these Icelandic families, but here, through the Utah Population Database, we actually have the opportunity to identify other, hopefully more common, gene mutations that permit people to survive despite having high risk developing the symptoms. So we know so much more about how this evolves. We need better treatments, but we have a lot of clues. When I started out, nobody had a very good idea about what might be done. How would you do this? People were using vitamins or food supplements without any direction on the understanding basic biology. So I'm extremely enthusiastic about what can be done.
Thank you. Next question.
My name is Morris Wells. A couple of panelists have talked about early diagnosis. With the increasing prevalence of Alzheimer's disease, are medical students getting significant training in dealing with that, or is that just something they pick up from the journals on their coffee break?
Well, I guess I'm the one to answer that, and this is part of the state plan, that there needs to be more training, not just of physicians, but of nurses, those providing care, and we aren't up to stuff. It just is that simple. We in our center do what we can to do this, but I think this is part of the state plan, is to actually have guidelines and requirements, really, for health professionals to know about this disease. We have a long ways to work.
Yeah, and I agree that's true nationally, and I think bigger picture, I think we as a country are going to face a massive workforce shortage of geriatric specialists in general, not just people with Alzheimer's, and that's not just geriatric physicians, that's geriatric social workers, that's geriatric nurses, and I think there is a significant need not only to work on the workforce development, so to speak, but also then on the education and training.
Thank you.
I might just add, in our state, with the increasing aging population, the conversion of folks from 65 and older to becoming older in our state, more nurses, more social workers, more in the health professions are going to be likewise converting to geriatrics and working with the aging population. And that is really where it's at in the next 15 to 20 years. And in terms of clinical trials and some of the breakthroughs that Dr. Foster talked about and is involved with, there are also clinical studies that nurses and social workers and others in elder care can be involved with that are also seeing exciting positive breakthroughs as well, and that we hear about each year at the annual Alzheimer's Research Conference, etc., including some that are happening in our state, one of which is a non-pharmacological intervention that is being studied and piloted in several states, including the state of Utah, called the New York University Caregiver Intervention, that is based on evidence that delays nursing home placement by a significant period of time, thus going to cost effectiveness. 80% of persons with this disease reside at home alone, we're finding, or at home with families, family members, etc. So this kind of study and development of these interventions is very exciting to see that caregivers can ameliorate symptoms through becoming very well educated on the symptoms and how to treat those symptoms on a non-pharmacological basis coupled with medication and the treatments that are being developed.
Dr. Foster, you mentioned earlier about the growing minority population, and in the report, research shows that Latinos are 1.5 times more likely, and African Americans are twice as likely to get the disease. Why?
Yes, well, we can do things about this. So we know that there specific risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. The most important risk factor is age. The increase in risk is exponential over the age of 65 or 70. But also, I mentioned that some of the abnormal proteins that accumulate in Alzheimer's disease occur decades before. And in populations who have difficulty with diabetes, hypertension, stroke, these are people who are much more likely to experience the cognitive effects of these changes in the brain. And we recognize now that it's very important to control blood sugar, blood pressure, keep physically active and socially engaged. And so populations that are disadvantaged with regard to their health care overall are more likely to be suffering from Alzheimer's disease in addition. And these are steps that we can take now. We don't have to, we're looking for a cure, we're working toward a cure, but we don't have to wait for a cure to improve care.
Okay. Next question. Oh, over here, I think so.
My name is Mazir Nurian, and this question kind of goes to anyone on the panel. I'm just wondering if you guys have looked into prevalence rates in more developed European countries to see if there's any differences in treatment and diagnosis over there, or is the Utah state plan modeled off any sort of other state plan? Is there any sort of gold standard or state that pioneered Alzheimer's research or plant?
Well, this is interesting. Matt may know about this, but there is, and not only is the Alzheimer's Association here in the United States, but there's actually an international Alzheimer's group, you know, which we're looking at cross-cultural issues. It turns out that just as each of the states have their own characteristic features, it's true that each of the countries have their own characteristic features, not just related to demographics, but also related to politics. And I actually believe that Canada is significantly ahead of the United States in the kinds of services and support that they provide for families. I used to practice in Michigan, and we would recommend if somebody could go to Canada across the Detroit River. They had amazing services that were available and to them at no cost and unavailable in the United States side. Likewise, Scandinavia, Holland, and in some areas, Japan have really led the way. I should not leave out Italy. It depends a little bit upon the issues that are involved, but they have led the way and can give us some models of care. I've recently served on a European Union task force looking at care, and it's amazing what difference it makes depending upon the healthcare system that the country has decided, what kinds of services are provided, how much it costs, and what kind of global efforts are made. Just to not to take this too long, it's an interesting topic, but in Great Britain, there's actually a series. Each community has a dementia specialist team. And the major barrier to getting care in Britain is reluctance of the family members to meet with the dementia care team. Here, there are no teams. And if there is a team, it's available only at cost. In fact, our center was developed when a wealthy Utah family discovered that no matter what their wealth was, that they had no access to services. And so they gave a donation to the University of Utah to establish our center because they hoped and prayed that other Utahns, no matter what their background, wouldn't experience the same problems that they did. So we have a lot to do to meet that family's ultimate desire, but that's our center's commitment. And what we're trying to do is take the best of dementia care throughout the world and be able to apply it in a practical sense here in Utah.
Thank you.
To the prevalence question, an organization called Alzheimer's Disease International in either 2009 or 2010 issued a World Alzheimer's report on prevalence worldwide. That's available on the organization's website, Alzheimer's Disease International. The one interesting thing about prevalence is because I don't think Western Europe, U.S., Canada, Australia, I don't think you see dramatic differences in prevalence. The real interesting thing is what's going to happen moving forward, and about two-thirds of the increase in global prevalence over the next 30 years is going to be in developing countries. As they live longer, as they deal with and have fewer people dying from things like malaria or tuberculosis or HIV/AIDS at a younger age, and as they start to age, the projections are that about two-thirds of the global prevalence increase is going to come in developing countries, which raise a whole new set of problems from a global health perspective.
Okay, we have just a couple, a few minutes left. Maybe we can try and squeeze in a couple more questions. So with that.
Norm Waitzman, I'm a health economist here at the University of Utah, and we have a number of budding health economists in the audience today. This has been a very illuminating discussion, and I've learned a lot, and the dimensions of this issue are profound, and I think we've gotten a sense of that. I would issue a cautionary note with respect to the economic, the way that we talk about win-win, the way that we talk about fiscal notes and the savings that are inevitably going to occur. I've done large studies on the cost of birth defects, the cost of preterm birth in the United States. Every community that's very much associated with these complain after we come up with very careful studies as to how low these figures are. In the case of birth defects, in the $10 billion range, in preterm birth, $20 billion range. And so there are reasons why those costs are lower than what's expected within the very concentrated communities in which they exist. And one is that when you say that $140 billion to $200 billion of costs go to people who have Alzheimer's, of course those are costs associated in the Medicare program and the Medicaid programs that would have taken place in any case had they Alzheimer's or not. And so it's very important to deal with this on the level. A win-win situation means that you save costs when you do something, but we as a society have to come to grips with winning is okay, and we don't have to win-win all the time.
Okay. Was very
Let me
quickly,
just respond to that, because we need you.
Yes.
very much we need you. And one of the reasons is that the costs is that our state legislature and I think the citizenry as a whole does not realize that the number one payer for dementia care in the state of Utah is the state of Utah government. And it has to do with how different costs are allocated. So if you look at the Medicaid budget, for example, there's child and family services and developmentally disabled and the elderly. But if you actually look at what care for the aged accounts for that, it's largely institutional care for people with dementing disease. People don't go to nursing homes without reason. I mean, they aren't flocking there just because they're old. There's an explanation. And we need people like you to actually analyze what is being spent and to translate that into a way that the state legislature and the state population as a whole understand how much they're paying, but also what they're paying for. And as I mentioned before, what they're paying for, what they've chosen to pay for as a political system, is the most expensive, least attractive options for care.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't disagree with you entirely. I would say I do believe, however, there are some places for savings. Let me give you one example. According to Medicare claims data, a senior with diabetes and not Alzheimer's, and compare that with a senior with diabetes and Alzheimer's, and the person with Alzheimer's is costing 81% more than the person with diabetes. Because what's happening with the Alzheimer's is it's complicating the treatment and management of the person with diabetes. So I do think there are some cost savings if we learn to deal with people with cognitive impairment within the healthcare system better, that can lower costs. I think on a big macro scale, I think you have I generally don't disagree with your point, but I do think there are some ways that you can get savings out of the system.
We've run out of time. I apologize, because I think this is being broadcast live, and I want to thank the audience, and I hope this presentation was very useful to you. And just very quickly, for those that were invited to the Panorama Room for the lunch at 2:00, I just want to remind you that we'll be at the Panorama Room. And finally, let me just invite those who might be interested to the public policy meeting on Tuesday, October 23rd at 4 p.m. at the Alzheimer's Association. You're welcome to come and ask the panel questions after this is over. Again, thank the Hinckley Institute for hosting this. Thank you, panel, and thank you.
Well done.